when government prints money certificates by the trillions and has nothing real to back those certificates, it diminishes its money's ability to buy real things, like food. Thus, government prints ever more certificates and more certificates and more certificates. Its money buys ever less food. This leads us to ask, who should determine the real price of food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 805th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on your favorite news talk radio station. Or, hey, perhaps you're streaming along with us on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com when you're tuned in way down there in Perth, Australia. Well, wherever you are and wherever you happen to be today, we want to welcome you aboard. This is the Food Chain Radio program, and I am Michael Olson with engineer Rick O'Shea right here in the boards. Rick, good morning.
Good day, Michael.
Folks, it does not take much of an imagination to think back to the dawn of humankind and see how food was most likely our first real money. Hey, Rick, I want to buy that stone axe you made, and I'll pay for it with this venison I killed. Got a deal? Got a deal? He missed it. Well, maybe he'd buy it, but as you can see, you know, that food really was a real money back then. So we now live in an age of modern times with the electronic gadgets of science fiction more familiar to us than in a year of garden fresh sweet corn. Food still is real money. As citizens of modern times, we sometimes lose track of what real money is and come to think of those paper certificates governments print as being real money. But unless those government certificates are guaranteed by something real, like gold or perhaps food, they are not real money. They are simply government certificates. Sometimes governments get carried away with their ability to print certificates. When that happens, the ability of those certificates to buy real things, like food, is diminished in direct proportion to the speed at which governments print certificates. As printing certificates is very easy for governments to do, sometimes they simply print too many, and things get out of hand. For example, in 1923 Germany, one loaf of bread cost, get this, 201 billion German marks. $201 billion for one loaf of bread. Imagine going to the grocery store, if you will, and paying $201 billion for a loaf of bread. Wow. Now, that 1923 loaf of bread was likely not worth more than a 2013 loaf of bread. What was worth less was that 1923 German government certificate. They had printed so many of them, people just quit believing in them. That food is real and government certificates are articles of faith is a major problem for governments that print certificates by the trillions. This problem of governments is inevitably shared by citizens, and so leads us to ask, what makes food move from farmer to consumer? What forces affect the value of food as it moves along the commercial food chain? And who should determine the true real price of food? Here to help us shop for an answer, we have Kara Newman, who is the author of The Secret Financial Life of Food. Kara, welcome to the food chain.
Hi, Michael.
So how did a person that writes about wine end up writing about the price of food, the secret financial life of food?
Well, I came to it pretty much through the back door. I started out my career as a financial writer, and I was writing about stocks and then about fixed income, and eventually I was given an assignment to write about commodities, but I didn't know much about commodities, so I had to go out and learn about it on my feet, and I took a class on commodities, and after I went through all the different pages about gold futures and oil futures, I came across the page that had to do with agricultural futures. And to me, it read rather like a menu. It was things like pork bellies and soybeans and corn, and that was actually one of those moments when the light bulb went on, and I knew that one day I'd be a food writer. So,
now,
finance first and food later.
Finance, but wait, are you a foodie now?
I am. Maybe I always was.
Uh-huh. And you live in the Big Apple, so how appropriate, right?
Exactly.
Now, can apples be commodities?
Well, anything can be a commodity if someone's willing to trade it. But at the moment, apples do not trade. They used to trade. We used to have actually a very active apple market. But they don't trade right now, but there are plans to set up an apple concentrate futures market.
Like apple juice, then, right? Concentrated apple juice.
Exactly, like the equivalent of orange juice concentrate, mm-hmm. but apples. Primarily, it's made in Latin American countries, but it's such an important food item and goes into so many other products that it really has a tremendous amount of economic value.
Well, you know, when I sent out a press release regarding the show and how I was going to be featuring the author of the Secret Financial Life of Food, I got an email back from one Vieira, and it's really interesting. So I'm going to kind of read part of it here to help set up this program. Vieira writes, I lived for 20 years in a non-market economy. The government owned all income-producing entities and just printed money. There was 100% employment and no stress because 10 people did the job of one person. There were short working hours and long paid holidays. There was free child care, free schools, university and technical training, free medical, hospital and dental, and very cheap public transportation. We were paid in cash, and there were no banks, credit cards, or loans. The postmen carried cash in their big bags and delivered cash to people personally. The government just printed money, but there was no inflation because the government also controlled prices. Well, poor Vieira now has to live in the United States where things are a little bit different than that. And so I thought maybe this would be a good opportunity to teach Vieira a little bit about how money gets its price here in the United States in a market economy. And you started out your book with a very interesting observation. When one of these financial types you were watching said something like, buy breakfast.
Oh, yes. That would be Jim Rogers. Buy breakfast.
What do you mean by buy breakfast? He wasn't talking about going down to the neighborhood cafe and buying breakfast, was he?
No. He was talking about pork bellies, which are no longer traded but were at the time. And those are used to make bacon. And he was talking about frozen orange juice futures. And he was saying you should be purchasing pork belly and orange juice futures, they're likely to go up. But a very concise way to say it, very food-driven, buy breakfast.
Buy breakfast. So there it is. And that's one of your introductions to the commodity markets. Well, let's talk a little bit about how food moves then from farm to consumer and the incredible food chain that's in between the two. I used a brief example of how food probably was one of our first currencies way back when, in just a direct barter where I'll trade you this for that. Is there any of that still in existence in the world? Do people still trade food for goods and services?
I imagine they probably do, but not very often, and certainly not here. Now we're really very much, we're much more sophisticated than that, and really we trade money for services and for goods.
So money's kind of like the intermediary then between to make barter more efficient and more possible, right?
Right, very right. It's all about the value.
Mm-hmm. And if we're growing apples in Washington State and selling them in Florida, it would be kind of hard to barter that without some kind of money interface to make it possible.
Exactly. And then there's also the concept of the value now as opposed to the value at a certain point in time. You're growing a product now, but you won't be able to harvest it for many, many months. And that's why the concept of financial futures really mm-hmm. sprung up around food. It seems a little counterintuitive sometimes to value something that you can't yet obtain. But some of the main drivers in the commodities market are things like weather and diseased crops. And as well, another big input now is the cost of fuel, but that's a whole other conversation.
So still going to pick that up in a little bit, but we're getting set up for a break here. Kara Newman, author of The Secret Financial Life of Food. But when we come back, I would like to pick up the commodity exchanges. And first of all, I'd like to talk about food as a commodity and why we think of it that way and how we can think of it that way. And I'd like to talk about the commodity exchange and especially the commodity exchanges of Chicago and why Chicago really became the focal point for the buying and selling of futures for foods. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson here. If you have a question with respect to the secret financial life of food and how food moves from farmer to consumer, pick up your phone and join us today. We're at 831-479-1080. Anywhere you want to be, you can call. If you're among our friends that are listening down there in Perth, Australia, you can pick up your phone and call us too. 831-479-1080. Michael Olson, Kara Newman, and you right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Hey, welcome back. Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking with Kara Newman. She, the author of The Secret Financial Life of Food, but also the spirits editor for Wine Enthusiast Magazine. Well, there you go. Now, what connection could spirits possibly have with food commodities, Kara?
Oh, you might be surprised. There used to be a liquor, the American Liquor Exchange.
In which they trade whiskey futures?
You got it. That was actually one of the most fun discoveries I had in researching the book. I didn't realize until I really started rolling up my sleeves and digging in that right after the repeal of Prohibition in the 30s, there was actually a formal liquor exchange set up to organize the prices for whiskey and champagne and cognac and all those other lovely potables.
Well, now, that's kind of a good introduction to the whole notion of commodities, because there's whiskey and there's whiskey futures. And when we're talking about whiskey, I think we're talking about something to drink. But when we're talking about whiskey futures, we're talking about a commodity, kind of. So what is the difference between food and a commodity?
Well, there's sometimes no difference, and sometimes there's a lot of difference. If you're talking about, say, coffee, it's most likely the same exact thing. We're talking, you know, a coffee bean is a coffee bean. But if you're talking about food, if you're talking about corn, for example, there can be a very big difference, and there's actually food grade versus feed grade.
Mm-hmm.
And all commodities are assigned grades, so there's a standard imposed on what's bought and sold.
Oh, now there's kind of like the foothold here or the handhold to really kind of come to grips with the question, right? Standardization. In that by placing standards on these things, we can turn, you know, food into a product that could be sold anywhere, correct?
Absolutely. And it may not be that lovely sweet corn that you're going to buy at the green market, but in terms of what's bought and sold, say, to grind up to make your cornflakes, it ought to be a standard grade that you can count on.
So then if you're a cereal manufacturer in Bangladesh and you want to buy some corn from Iowa, you can call them on, you can buy futures or a certain grade of corn, and that's kind of what you're going to get, almost guaranteed, right?
Absolutely. And you want to make sure, for example, that you don't get the grade of corn that's used to feed livestock and is distilled into ethanol. I mean, that would not be a pleasant surprise to have.
No, it wouldn't.
Have some checks in place.
So the whole notion of commoditization of food, start with standardizing them, and thus in the standardizing of food, you can really establish a uniform grade so that people can buy and sell all over the place. And then once people start buying and selling all over the place, we can develop more formal commodity exchanges. So let's go back to the history of commodity exchanges. And, of course, the place to start would be Chicago. But why? Why Chicago?
Geography is destiny. That's where all of the food was made for quite a stretch of time. We certainly had exchanges in New York and in New Orleans, which was a big importing area up until the Civil War. That's where a lot of the coffee and sugar came in. But really, the Midwest, that was the place to be. You know, those golden waves of grains.
They didn't call it the breadbasket for nothing, right?
Exactly. And all the cattle, the Chicago stockyards, the pork processing plants, they were all within easy distance. And that's why all the mercantile really sprung up in the Midwest for a time.
Mm-hmm. So how did the commodity exchange start? Can you kind of give us a brief idea? You could probably take us way back in history for that one, right?
Oh, absolutely. Really, as long as we've had food, we've needed a way to exchange one item for another. So if you were someone who is, say, we're going back to barter here. If you were someone who was growing, let's say, potatoes, and your neighbor is someone who raises cattle, you might want to swap one for the other. And then that way you would both have corn, and you would both have potatoes, you would both have meat. It would be something like that. And what developed over time was, of course, the sense that we have all of these inputs that possibly affect the food going forward. You can have a major storm, and that can impact your crop for months down the road. So you need to be able to have what's called a to-arrive contract. You're going to, without getting too much into details, you're selling that crop before it's actually sold. It's to arrive later.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the basis of the futures market.
What happens when you can't deliver?
You lose money.
Okay, so you have to pay back or something like that, then, right? Because you've already sold it. You don't even own it anymore.
Right, exactly. And then there's always somebody else who's willing to take on that same risk. At heart, the futures market is about hedging risk.
Mm-hmm. So then the key element to understanding commodities really is distance, because in setting up a commodity exchange, it's all about dealing or working with people who are a distance away. If you're dealing with your neighbor, you can still go, hey, I'll trade you my corn for your potatoes. But if you're working with somebody on the other side of the world, then you have to have a commodity. So the distance is really the difference. Now, you talked about how in Omnivore's Dilemma, the whole notion of commodities is kind of disparaged. Why was that? What was the comment there?
Michael Pollan, the author of Omnivore's Dilemma, is certainly not a fan of the commodities markets, and there are good reasons to disapprove of the way that commodities trade really drives food prices up. It's a huge problem. It's not always the farmer's friend. And I tell people, if you don't want to be part of the commodity system, the best thing you can do is just buy direct from farmers. That's the best way to opt out.
Mm-hmm. So that we're going back to this whole notion of distance. Would there be another way of dealing with somebody on the other side of the world other than through a formal commodity exchange where there are established uniform grades? I can't see of any other way of doing it. Can you?
Now everything's electronic, and we're almost always dealing with someone on the other
side of somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. I was talking to, you want to talk about mingling food and beverage. For me, I was talking to someone just yesterday who was talking about bringing in organic sake, because the way the sake world works now, there's no such thing as pure rice from from anywhere in China. It's all been, or Japan, it's all been corrupted by GMOs.
GMOs. Oh.
It's literally taken rice grown in California under organic conditions and brought it to Japan to be distilled and then brought back to his restaurant in New York, which is, of course, a huge carbon footprint, but it's the only way he can get truly organic sake.
So this whole notion, then, depends on uniform grades. I mean, you have to have established grades of what is organic, then.
Yeah. And organic really doesn't factor into the commodities system. The way it's set up, their contracts have very specific outlines. You're going to commit to delivering X amount of Y product at Z time, and it doesn't really say it's going to be organic or it's going to be delicious. It's about quantity and as much of a certain quality as you can, but it's not the same sort of quality that a foodie really thinks about. It's more about the quantity and the time.
Now, so a commodity, the way a commodity exchange works is you have two people sitting on other sides of the room and somebody in the middle, right?
It's a lot of buying and selling in between commodities traders, but there are really a lot of different points. I feel like I should also kind of jump in and say these days almost nothing is actually delivered. When commodities were first created in history, the concept of futures, you really did have to be concerned about delivery. Now you have commodities traders that are trading cocoa who have never seen an actual cocoa bean, never set foot on a cocoa plantation. It's more of an abstract concept now. Or if you want to talk about...
It's certificates, then. Hey, folks, this is The Food Chain. Going to have to take a quick break, but this is getting fun with Carol Newman, who is the author of The Secret Financial Life of Food, and you, 831-479-1080. Do stay tuned. Hey, welcome back. This is The Food Chain radio program. Today we're talking about how money is... affects the price, how value of money affects the price of food, I guess, and how food affects the value of money, and how food moves from the farmer through the food retail and commercial food chain all the way to us, and what mechanism that takes. You know, I was got to thinking, you were, Carol Newman, you were talking about organic sake. We could probably set up an organic sake exchange right here in the studio, right? We could have buyers on one side of the table and sellers on the other. And Carol Newman, as the author of The Secret Financial Life of Food, could sit in the middle and she says, okay, I'm opening up this transaction. What do we have to sell? How would that work?
Well, I think for something like that, it would be pretty straightforward. But mm-hmm. when you're talking about the commodities market, often you have commodities exchanging hands several times before it gets from the grower to the end user.
Sure.
I talked to somebody who works with one of the major commodities exchanges, and I was trying to figure out how many times the coffee in my Starbucks, my daily addiction, would have turned over before making its way from the grower to me. And he said, it's got to be at least five or six times before it goes to the person who actually uses the beans at Starbucks.
Wow. And of course, each time somebody buys and sells it, the price to the consumer has to go up, right?
Not necessarily. It goes up and down, and it actually can go a long way towards mitigating major price swings in the end. And actually, I feel like one of the dirty secrets that nobody really knows is that you get all these crazy swings in the commodities market, but they don't necessarily affect what you pay at Starbucks or at the supermarket for a very long time. There's about a year and a half delay from the commodities market to you.
Now, is that because, you know, people like Starbucks buy futures on coffee so that their price is locked in for a significant time in the future?
It's partly that, but it's also because there are so many swings going on along the way. It goes up, it goes down, it goes way up, it goes way down. It's all about the longer term trend when you're talking about the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, it doesn't even affect you as much as you think it might. For something like Starbucks, it certainly does. You know, the product is coffee. That's the main input there. So probably the other big input you're talking about is retail space. If you're talking about something like, to go back to cornflakes, the stat that always comes to mind for me is when you buy packaged food, only 15 to 20 cents of every dollar goes towards the raw commodities used in that product. And the rest is things like packaging and manufacturing and transporting it from point A to point B, the retail for the supermarket itself. In the end, the commodities price, even if there's a very wide swing up and down, it doesn't make as big an impact as you think it might.
What are some of the big things that really influence the price of commodities? Let's say corn. Of course, corn is really, you know, the crop upon which America was built. Is that a fair thing to say?
Oh, absolutely. Corn and grain, no doubt. Those are the big ones.
So what are some of the things, you know, we look at the price of corn and we think, well, there's, of course, weather.
Of course, and the drought that's been going on in the U.S., huge. Really just an enormous impact, driving up corn prices in a very big way, and will be for some time.
Mm-hmm. So if you're betting upon the price of corn 2 years ago for delivery in, let's say, 2014, and you...
You're in trouble.
And so, well, unless you somehow figured out that there was going to be a big drought.
What? There you go. It depends which side of the trade you're on and what you're betting against. That's true. That is very true.
So you can win or lose whether the market goes up or down if you're betting on the price of grain, right?
Exactly. There's always a winner and a loser in these transactions. But there's just, in the end, there's just so much money to be made. It almost doesn't matter, it seems, from a larger perspective. I mean, we have the New York Stock Exchange actually combining with a major commodities exchange because there's just so much more money to be made in commodities than in equities.
Yeah, and the price, because of the price swings, correct?
Absolutely.
The more the price swings, the more opportunity there is to win or lose.
Exactly. It's all about the volatility in the markets and the volume of the transactions. And we've had commodities that have traded very well for a long period of time because, for example, eggs. Eggs used to be a tremendously speculative market because there was so much money to be made. It was a seasonal market. And
because the hens only laid a certain time of year.
Right. And not so much anymore. They're, you know, now we have agricultural advances. Eggs can be laid year-round, and we have better refrigeration. That's no longer such a perishable market. But there was a time when it was extremely speculative and volatile, lots of money to be made. And when it stopped being so speculative and volatile, then no more egg trading. It just went away little by little. By the 1970s, it was gone.
Somebody figured out that they could turn on the lights in a hen house, and they destroyed the commodity market for eggs, right?
Yeah, there you go.
There you go. So let's go to the phones and see what we can come up with here today. We have, we'll start with Teresa. Teresa, are you there?
I am here.
Welcome to the
Hi,
food
Michael.
Chain.
I wanted to correct something that you said in your intro.
Okay.
Since the Christmas surprise of 1913, the Federal Reserve Act, the government has not created the money. The banks have created the money.
Oh.
And that was also true in Germany under the Weimar inflation. That was Reichsbank money, not government created, which was inflating to that level.
Mm-hmm.
What made Hitler so popular was actually that he adopted the American system, which we had rejected at that time. He had the government create the money, which ended unemployment and made them self-sufficient for 4 years with no persecution of the Jews and without foreign invasions. So my question for Kara is, in North Dakota, where the bank is the government and is even the local government, are they able to produce food without selling their future to speculators?
There you go. That's an interesting question. Kara?
You have smart listeners.
No, that we do. We're very proud of our listeners.
And I don't have an answer specific to North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
What I can offer is, although I don't know for certain exactly how it's working there, I'm pretty certain that the prices would be set in North Dakota and elsewhere in part through what's going on elsewhere in the commodities market. There's a concept called price discovery. In order for a farmer in North Dakota or elsewhere to figure out how much they can charge for an item, often the prices quoted in the commodities markets provide a handy guide for discovering the price that the market will bear. So there is some impact in there along the line, no matter where the product is made.
Teresa, quick follow-up?
I think that it's something that we should be considering, whether there's a way that we can actually sustain our own food production and do it locally and not have to depend on these middlemen who are just trying to put as much space as possible between producers and consumers so that they can
Exactly what Michael Pollan was talking about. Thank you, Teresa, for the call, folks. We're going to take a quick break. Right back with Kara Newman and you, and Bill's up next. Do stay tuned. Well, this is The Food Chain, and we are talking food. We're talking food as money. And we're talking about the value of food in terms of money. And by golly, when it gets right down to it, we're talking about the history of our country in terms of its food and how that food became money with Kara Newman, who is the author of The Secret Financial Life of Food, and the whole notion that our nation the history of our nation could be told in the history of its food and the development of our food industries. I guess where would it start? Would start kind of in Chicago, would it not, Kara? Where the great bulk of the nation's food was produced in the Midwest and then sold to the population centers of the Eastern Seaboard?
I think a lot of it starts in the Midwest, but it's not only in the Midwest. There was certainly a time around the 1800s or so, even earlier, when markets were so localized and fragmented. Since you're in California, I thought you'd be interested to know that in the 1800s, there were so many grain exchanges up and down the coast of California. There was the L.A. Grain Exchange, the San Francisco Grain Exchange. There was one in Seattle. There was one in Portland. And then in the Midwest, where more of the food was grown on a longer basis, eventually a lot of the manufacturing and distribution really came from the Midwest. That's where everything really crystallized and stuck, even to this day. But even then, it was fragmented for a while. You had the grain exchange on one side of town. You had the Chicago Board of Trade and the patrician white glove types. And on the other side of town, you had the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and they were the rough and tumble immigrants. It was the Irish and the Italians, and they were trading the scrappier meat futures, cattle and pork.
And from everything I read in the news, Chicago still seems to hold on to that character, I guess. Hey, let's go to the phones. Folks, if you'd like to join us today, we're at 831-479-1080. We're talking about food, and food is money, and the secret financial life of our food. And with us right now, we have Bill. Bill, welcome to The Food Chain.
Yeah, I was wondering, when I was working down in Katrina at that time, corn was $3.50 a bushel. And as soon as the government said it was going to be used for fuel, it almost doubled. And if I remember correctly, there was a bunch of northern Africa countries like Tunisia and maybe Algiers, that there was food riots over there when the price of corn went up so high. I'm wondering what would happen if we stopped using corn for fuel, and would that bring the price down? I think at that time it was like $3.50 a bushel. I don't know what it is now.
Bill, that's a great question. Can we play with it for just a little bit? Let's say we're in our imaginary commodity exchange here at the studios, the radio studios, and you as a buyer are sitting one side of the table, and me as a seller, I'm sitting at the other side, and Kara's there, and Kara opens the exchange, and she says, Michael Olson has corn to sell in 2016, and you happen to know that the government is going to end its program of case of using corn as an ethanol base, what would you bid? Higher or lower?
Are you asking me or the caller?
I'm asking the caller.
Well, if I imagine the price would go lower.
Wow, wouldn't it? But,
yeah, quite a bit, maybe.
So then what would you do, Kara? If you knew the price was going to collapse, what kind of future contract would you buy?
Well, you'd want to sell short.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that?
It's funny. I'm having trouble focusing on the question because I just know in my heart that we're never going to stop using corn for ethanol.
I'm speculating here. I'm trying to raise the whole notion of how people look into the future and buy and sell on what they think is going to happen. If you think the price is going to collapse on something, corn or grain or anything, you want to sell it short. But how do you buy what kind of contract would that be that you sell short with?
In essence, you're selling something that you don't have to then buy at a future point in time when the market's gone down and the price is cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Is there a name for that? Is there called a put or a call or something like that?
I'm going to step back and just say that I'm a food writer rather than.
Okay, fair enough.
Trader,
that's fair enough. I don't know either, so I don't know anybody who does. But I think that's the way it works. Is that if Bill knows, you know, Bill weighs a perfectly reasonable question here. We're using corn to make ethanol with, so I can burn it in our vehicles. What if we change that policy? What if we said, hey, this isn't working. We have an abundant supply of hydrocarbons in the ground in North Dakota. It all goes through the Bank of North Dakota, of course, and they control everything. But that being said, we now know that we don't need corn for ethanol. So, you know, I'm just thinking, boy, that would really raise havoc with a commodity exchange, would it not?
It would be a problem. And it's interesting to think about all the ways that corn is used for things that are not feeding us. But it's still important.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, I think the caller also raised an important point about the demand for food around the world and the fact that the world population is growing.
Well, let's pick that up. Bill, can you stick with us for a minute?
Oh, sure.
Okay, folks, this is the food chain. The value of corn as food, not just here, but around the world. We will be right back on the food chain. Michael Olson with Kara Newman, author of The Secret Life of Food, and Bill. Do stay tuned. Well, so much to talk about and so little time to talk about it in. We have Kara Newman, author of The Secret Financial Life of Food. We're talking about the impact of food on money and the impact of the price of money on food, and it works both ways, as witnessed by the fact that at one time, 1923, a single loaf of bread in Germany cost 201 billion marks. Wow. So food, in a sense, really is the only real money or something real to base money on. And that's kind of where we're talking about. Bill, you were talking about what happens when we use corn for things other than eating and the price of that corn. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering how many politicians got into the commodity market when they realized that corn was going to be used for fuel.
Well, they probably had access to that knowledge before anybody else, right, Kara?
Oh, I'm sure. I'll tell you, one of the things I found, no matter what the era, no matter what the commodity, there's always someone getting in there. There's always a scandal. There's always someone making money in ways they shouldn't be.
Well, it's always about the information, right? I mean, if you know that the drought is going to have a severe impact on the availability of corn, and you know it before anybody else, you can make the bet before anybody else, correct?
Depending on how you get that information, yes. If you know it through a legal way, then that's a very important piece of information to have and potentially a very lucrative one, too.
Now, is there a way of governing legal and illegal information in the commodity markets? I mean,
yeah, we have we have lots of regulatory bodies that oversee. We have the Securities and Exchange Commission. We have the CFTC. Again, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but we certainly do have ample regulatory.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Bill, go ahead.
Oh, that's it, Mike. Thanks anyway.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Really appreciate it. Well, what happened, do you think, to that gal, Vieira, who lived in a country where the government controlled the price of grain and the availability of money? She said that that the postman would deliver money to everybody in cash envelopes, and the value of food was always the same. Could we do that here? Would our commodities exchange work, or would we even need a commodities exchange if the government simply said, this will be the price of corn, and that will be that?
It sounds utopian in some ways and disastrous in others. It would certainly have a serious impact on people who were trying to make money.
Mm-hmm. Like farmers?
Like farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And manufacturers and retailers, I suspect it would be very difficult to implement here.
What if the government said you can, well, I guess we can look at history and see what happened. You know, there's situations like China where essentially they walled off the country and said, the farmers, you will grow this and we will pay you that. And it didn't quite work out too well. In the end, it fell apart. And as did Vieira's country, wherever that country was. It sounded like a perfect paradise, but for some reason, I asked her what happened. And she just said that it went away. They chased it all away for some reason. Perhaps it's as Margaret Thatcher said, it always runs out of other people's money. Karen Newman, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I enjoyed your read. I especially enjoyed the part about the liquor trade and how whiskey, the commodity futures for whiskey, was bought and sold and traded. And I think few people probably realize the impact of spirits. Of the market for spirits has really impacted our food supply. So thank you for joining us, and thank you all for tuning in out there.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live. Your source for news, sports, traffic, and weather. AM 1080, KSCO, Santa Cruz, San Jose, Salinas, and Monterey.
CBS News, I'm Gary Nahum. The hostage ordeal in the Algerian desert is apparently over. Algerian special forces stormed a natural gas complex in the Sahara Desert today, ending a standoff with Islamist extremists. Have left at least 19 hostages, including one American and 29 militants dead. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta.
Just as we cannot accept terrorism attacks against our cities, we cannot accept attacks against our citizens and our interests abroad.
Panetta says much remains sketchy about what happened in that gas field. This hostage, is relieved to be alive.
We're very happy, and the guys who picked us up, the rescue guys, were wonderful. They were like long-lost friends. And they all said, this is not Algeria. They are not. Terrorists do not come from Algeria. We are so embarrassed. We apologize.
Ever since the siege began Wednesday, information has been unclear and conflicting about the ordeal. President Obama kicking off the three-day celebration of his second inaugural with service projects at a Washington-area school and other places. Presidential historian Douglas Brinkley says the importance of the president's second inaugural address cannot be underestimated.
This time around, I think the speech the president gives is going to be very important because you're having less balls, smaller crowds, lower enthusiasm factor, but he can make up for that by having words that someday might be carved in marble.
The president will be sworn in tomorrow under terms of the Constitution. President Obama's weekly address furthering his effort to crack down on gun violence.
It's time for Congress to require a universal background check for anyone trying to buy a gun.
Gun rights advocates opposing new efforts to curb firearms have designated this as a special day.
I'm Jim Crisula. Firearms supporters, including Fremont Brown, say Gun Appreciation Day will focus on President Barack Obama's gun control initiatives.
He's not supposed to make legislation. That's up to Congress, not him.
Randy Bernard with the organization Move On talks about gun rights advocates.
They're concerned, and they're probably rightly so, that some reasonable limits now might be placed on gun purchases.
There will be dozens of Gun Appreciation Day events nationwide. Jim Crisula, CBS News.
In the Republicans' weekly address, Oklahoma Congressman James Lankford also calls on Congress to face the government's spending problems and approve a budget.
Federal overspending is now actually dragging our economy down rather than lifting our families up.
Former Baltimore Orioles manager Earl Weavers died. He was a winner, and his confrontations with umpires were legendary.
And you'll have your chance tomorrow.
Oh,
you got it as quick as you can.
What is wrong with you?
You ain't no good.
No, you aren't either.
Yeah,
you aren't either.
You ain't no good.
Weaver won 1,480 games as a skipper of the Orioles in 17 seasons. He took the team to the World Series four times, won only once. That was in 1970. He was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1996. Earl Weaver was 82 years old. This is CBS News.
Quietus contains homeopathic ingredients traditionally used to provide relief.
Do you have constant ringing in your ears? Does it drive you crazy? Maybe you hear that buzzing and it drowns out what other people are saying. It's impossible to focus. That ringing is the last thing you hear before you go to sleep. Let me guess. You're hearing that ringing right now. Millions of people suffer from tinnitus, that constant ringing in the ear. Now there's relief. It's called Quietus. Thousands of people have used Quietus to stop ringing in the ear, to stop that hissing sound. You'll love it. You won't have to ask people to repeat themselves. You won't have to sleep with loud fans. Finally, you'll be able to enjoy some peace and quiet. If you're suffering from tinnitus, I urge you to try Quietus.
Call right now for your risk-free trial of Quietus at 1-800-485-4617. That's 1-800-485-4617. Stop the ringing now. 1-800-485-4617. That's 1-800-485-4617.
A sheriff's deputy in Southern California says that actor Robert Wagner has not consented to an interview in a renewed inquiry into the 1981 death of his wife, Natalie Wood. A story from KNX reporter Margaret Carrero.
Investigators have reached out to Wagner several times since reopening the case just over a year ago, but he's refusing to talk, which he can do because he's not a suspect, but he is a key witness, Lieutenant John Corina.
He's the last person to see her alive and a missing puzzle piece here. We've talked to everyone else on that boat and about 100 other plus witnesses.
Wagner's attorney, Blair Burke, issued a statement saying he's fully cooperated with the Sheriff's Department investigation over the past 30 years and has nothing new to add.
What he originally told investigators back in 1981 is different what he wrote in his book and what he's been saying to news periodicals along the way. He hasn't talked to law enforcement, but he's changed his story from what he told us back then. All we're trying to do is gather the facts, find out the truth of what happened.
Actor Robert Chu has died. He played a character named Proposition Joe on the HBO series The Wire. He was 52. Gary Nunn, CBS News.
KLCO News Time 10:05. I'm Rick O'Shea with a traffic and weather update. Highway 1 northbound around the Monterey Bay moving at the limit this hour. No problems southerly as well. Watsonville south to Castroville Marina ultimately into Monterey. Not a problem. 68 westbound is a little bit slow right on top of San Venancio Road. And again, a Lorellis grade, not too bad, however. 101 and 17 are both at the limit, northbound and southbound. Deer was hit and killed. It's in the roadway, 152 eastbound, close to Casa de Fruta. In your forecast today, a lot of sunshine and mild temperatures around the central coast. Highs today will be in the upper 60s along the oceans, middle to upper 60s, with some low 70s inland. Very nice. Light winds out of the northeast between 5 and 10 miles per hour. Watch out. There is a high surf advisory in effect until 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon with a swell.